Today's Between the Rows podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Gowan Canada, the go-to company. Gowan's herbicide portfolio includes Avidex and Fortress, which control Group 1 and Group 2 resistant wild oats. Don't let wild oats rob your yields. Use Avidex and Fortress to stop them in their tracks. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Shannon Van Rays of Country Guide educates us about halal meat and why it could spell opportunity for Canadian producers. Phil Franz Workington of Commodity News Service Canada provides his insights on the latest market developments. We'll also hear from Western producers Robin Booker about the surprising lack of phosphorus in Saskatchewan's farmland. Plus, Leanne Minogue of Grain News brings you her comment of the week. All this on Between the Rows with today's host, Robert Arneson.
15 years ago, the average canola yield in Saskatchewan was around 25 bushels per acre, but now the average is closer to 40. However, the amount of phosphorus in the soil has been going in the other direction, and Saskatchewan farmland may now have the lowest phosphorus levels in Canada. To talk about what's going on, we're joined by Robin Booker, a reporter with the Western Producer in Saskatoon. Hi, Robin.
How's it going, Robert?
Good. So, you know, I've looked at this issue in Manitoba with soybean growers in eastern Manitoba taking their soil phosphorus levels to basically down to nothing. How bad is the situation in Saskatchewan right now?
Well, I was actually quite surprised when I went to a session with Stuart Brandt at the Sask, at the Agri-M sessions here. And Grant was talking about how the in Saskatchewan the levels are getting worse. So he said that the average levels is down to 14 parts per million, which is below the critical threshold of 15 parts per million.
So how would that compare to, say, other prairie provinces, other parts of Canada?
In Saskatchewan, the phosphorus levels were 14 parts per million. They were 21 in Alberta, 19 in Manitoba, and 35 in Ontario. And again, the critical level was 15 parts per million. And of course, that is crop dependent. Crops like soybean or corn, the critical level is actually 20 parts per million.
So do we have an understanding of why this is happening in Saskatchewan in particular? Like, what's going on?
He brought it down to the yield potential of crops. Like he said, the yield has gone up. So he looked at the yields in the seed guide, and for canola alone, since 1995, the yield potential is up 90%. And he said that with the phosphorus levels producers have been applying has remained the same.
So obviously, like, nitrogen application rates have gone up. Why not also increase your phosphate or phosphorus application rates? Like, what's going on here in terms of producer practices? Why the reluctance to apply phosphorus? Do we have an understanding of that?
You know, he didn't really mention that in his presentation. What I could think of is that it's pretty obvious if you're being cheap with nitrogen when it comes to your crop. When it comes to phosphorus, it might not be as glaring if your levels are getting a little bit low compared to nitrogen.
So if you don't apply nitrogen, you see it right away the next year in terms of yield, whereas phosphorus, you might not see that for a few years down the road. But that's kind of what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yeah, and you know, there will be, your yields will be limited by your phosphorus levels over time, definitely, though.
So is there, you know, some solution to this problem, or a simple solution, or is this sort of a more of a long-term issue for Saskatchewan farmers?
Brad talked a little bit about, replacing the phosphorus levels, and he had a couple different strategies. Like, for instance, he said you could do a one-time correction. You can go out and band in the phosphorus levels, or you can even broadcast. Or over time, you can just add more phosphorus than you're taking out with the crops, and you can correct your levels that way. Some farmers tend to wait till the phosphorus price is cheaper, and then really sort of build up their levels then, which can work quite well, he said. Whereas other farmers will just slowly do it over time, like every year, I guess.
Well, both of us go to a lot of farm meetings, but, I don't hear this topic come up very often. Is it being discussed more in Saskatchewan now, this issue of phosphorus deficiency?
looking at the 81% of the soil samples sent in to SASC labs in 2015 were below the critical measure. I think there is a level of concern with soil scientists who know that this needs to be addressed. In terms of farmers, you know, like every year we're still taking out more phosphorus than is being replaced in Saskatchewan. So it seems that, you know, there still hasn't been, this knowledge hasn't really translated into practice yet for a lot of farmers, I believe.
So there's a bit of a lag in terms of the advice being given and then the actual practices on the farm. That connection hasn't been made yet.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Robin. Well, we've been speaking with Robin Booker, a reporter with the Western Producer in Saskatoon. Thanks again for taking part, Robin.
Thanks, Robert.
You can read more about this topic in the Western Producer or online at producer.com. This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Robert Arneson. Canada has more than 1 million Muslims, and halal meat is readily available in big cities across the country. But few Canadians understand what halal means and how it's different from other meat. Shannon Van Rays, Country Guide field editor, recently spoke to large and small players in the halal meat sector in Canada, and she joins us now. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Robert. How are you this morning?
Good, good. So I've read your story, and interestingly, that I've been to the store that you mentioned at the in the lead of the story. I've been there many times, but never actually bought halal meat. I've always bought things like, flatbread and other sort of traditional Middle Eastern foods. And the reason I never bought halal meat is that I don't know what it is. So can you tell me what help me out? What is halal meat?
Well, halal meat, the easiest way to start is the word halal. It means permissible. So it is allowable under Islamic dietary requirements. Now, what that means or what you need to get to that point depends on which branch of Islam you follow. But generally, it means that a healthy animal was slaughtered by a Muslim. They say a prayer while they harvest the animal, so basically thank God for it, and is killed with an incision to the neck. So it's not that different than most other types of slaughter. However, in large settings, such as a cattle plant or something industrial, it does take some modifications. So in some places, they might have an imam there saying a prayer, or they might have a button that is pushed before every animal is harvested. But really, it's not that different.
Okay. So obviously you spent a lot of time preparing and writing this story. What got you interested in this topic?
Like yourself, I've been to Yusuf Abdulrahman's store, Halal Meat Center, many times. And I've had the opportunity to be in halal slaughter plants in New Zealand and also see halal slaughter in Tunisia. So, and those are very different. In Tunisia, it was more sort of someone bring the goat behind the store and let's see where this goes. And of course, in New Zealand, it was very large scale. It was very much like any other Western plant, but their market was Indonesia. So they slaughter there and then ship to Indonesia. So, I mean, personally, I've seen it and it's always interested me from that aspect. But given the current political climate, I also think it's really important that we understand these sorts of things and we don't have misconceptions about them.
So what are some of the misconceptions that you found out?
Unfortunately, you don't have to look very long online. If you Google halal slaughter, it's often used as a front for Islamophobia or anti-immigrant sentiment. There's a lot of misconceptions that this is cruelty to animals, that this is a barbaric way of doing it, and that fuels a lot of hatred, frankly. So that's something that some far-right groups have latched onto. One of the people I spoke to for the story was Miles Kleiner at Sungold Meats in Alberta. And he's experienced this quite frequently. He's not Muslim, but he operates a halal plant. And they do get calls from people with extreme right views. And they use halal meats to pin that on. And that's just not accurate.
So it sounds like you were trying to clear up some of these misunderstandings or misconceptions in your story. That was one of the purposes of the story?
I was definitely hoping to do that. But I also wanted to let producers know that there's an opportunity here. That this is an underserved market. That if they're looking for a niche or have a smaller operation, people are looking for halal, particularly in lamb and goat. So there's opportunities there. And if people are comfortable and they understand it, this is something they can explore.
One thing I was kind of surprised by in the story is that you said that many non-Muslims are buying halal meat. I guess I wouldn't have thought of that because I would have assumed that it was just something that people who are of a Muslim faith would buy. Why are non-Muslims buying halal meat?
Well, I often buy halal meat because it's simply products you can't get. Quail is not usually in the market. Sometimes you might want duck. And those items that are more niche often fall into the halal category. The same with lamb. If you want fresh lamb and you don't want something that was packaged in New Zealand, who knows when, and shipped across the ocean, you can go to a lot of these stores and have something that was killed the day before, butchered the way you want it. So that's definitely a benefit for the consumer. Other consumers, and this is something Canadian Grocer pointed out, they believe that it is a more humane way to slaughter an animal in some cases, whether or not that's, you know, it's not one side or the other. I mean, slaughter is in some effects always going to be slaughter, but there is a view that because it's done by hand, it's more humane, a little more personable. And so some people from an animal welfare standpoint specifically buy halal.
So is the opportunity for Canadian livestock producers and meat processors to serve the Canadian market, or is it this, do they have an opportunity to sell this, their products, to the global market? Like, what's the big opportunity here?
I think it's both. I think one of the niche markets that I found that surprised me was there's no halal beef gelatin really in Canada. Now, you need beef gelatin to make candy. So there's no halal candy made in Canada. And that's a huge, huge area. There was a study done by Nourish Marketing, and they found that more than 70% of Canadian Muslims don't think candy is halal by default. So what that means is they're looking for halal candy and no one was making it. Almost a million people want candy that's not there. So that's a huge opportunity, I think. I also think there's a big opportunity for Canadian lamb. Young Muslims don't just want halal. They also want local. They want organic. And they want to be able to buy that in the supermarket. And you can't right now. It's very difficult. In terms of overseas, in the Middle East, particularly the United Arab Emirates, Canada is seen as, you know, a pristine sort of agricultural land, and there's a premium on Canadian products. So Canadian halal beef is sold at a premium just because it's Canadian in those countries. So that's another real opportunity for people that are looking to export.
So I guess, as I also found in your story, is that, you know, obviously halal meat's available in big cities. Is that changing in Canada, that it's more available in smaller towns, or is that still a problem for people who are Muslim faith in smaller communities?
It's still a problem in smaller communities. If you do find it in rural stores, it's much more expensive. And people, there's a misconception that, you know, we only have new immigrants in large urban centers. And well, most new immigrants do have support networks and choose to move to larger centers. If you look at Altona, they have quite a significant population that's immigrated there from all over the world. And there's definitely people there who are looking for halal food. And instead of shopping in Altona, they drive to Winnipeg. So I think that small suppliers and small grocery stores shouldn't overlook this either. And if you have a clientele that's asking for it, supplying that could really do a lot for local farmers.
Thanks, Shannon. I've learned quite a bit today that I didn't know about halal meat. So we've been speaking with Shannon Van Rays, Country Guide field editor. Thanks again, Shannon.
Thank you.
This is Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Robert Arneson. It's become clear to anyone paying attention that Donald Trump will not be a normal president. His unpredictability is having a massive impact on everything, including the price outlook for things like soybeans. Here to talk to us about President Trump and the commodity market is Phil Franz Workington, a reporter with Commodity News Service Canada. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Robert.
So, obviously, a lot of people are talking about Donald Trump these days. Is he really having an impact on the commodities market, or is this a bit overblown?
He is, yes, he is having an impact, although what that impact is depends on who you talk to from day to day. It's mainly a sense of uncertainty over everything, in that markets don't know what, you know, one tweet from President Trump can make prices go up or down, and then the grain markets have so far been, you know, not directly impacted, but they are that sense of caution and uncertainty is definitely being felt in the grain markets.
So is the biggest concern some sort of trade war with China, or what are the concerns?
China is in the old days, we would say China was the wild card, but now they're the steady hand by comparison. But the, trade war with China is, there's definitely analysts talking about that, and the concern is China buys a lot of U.S. soybeans and corn, and if there's any disputes there, then China goes elsewhere to buy what they need. That weighs on U.S. prices and, in turn, prices in Canada. Although, the on the flip side of that, Canada, you know, we're not the U.S., so might see some extra Chinese interest come our way if there is any issues there.
So there would be maybe some sort of price bump for canola, possibly, or what would be the best case scenario for Canadian farmers?
Best case scenario would be flat as far as canola goes, with the losses in soybeans made up for by increased demand for canola. But in truth, Chinese demand would more likely, instead of shifting north to us, drop south to South America and buy cheaper beans from Brazil and Argentina.
So besides President Trump news, what else is happening in the market? Isn't normally February a fairly quiet month, or what's the expectation for this February?
Yeah, February is quiet. It's, as far as Canada and North America is concerned, we're, you know, in the middle of winter, still a ways away from planting weather and those sorts of issues. But the world doesn't stop. In South America, that is where the attention is, aside from the geopolitical tensions elsewhere in the world. The South American crops are in the middle of growing, and the weather there from day to day is providing some direction for the grains and oil seeds up here.
So is there generally good weather conditions, good growing conditions in South America this year, or how would you describe the situation down there?
It's back and forth. It was, and if you kind of look at the prices in earlier January, soybean prices were climbing higher. Canola was following along with that, and that was all due to people were worried about excessive moisture and flooding in Argentina. The weather turned drier, and those concerns eased away, and prices dropped. And now, overall, the expectations are for big crops out of both Argentina and Brazil, although there are still areas of concern, but overall they're still going to be growing big crops that will be finding their way to market eventually.
So here in Canada, it's obviously very early to know about spring plantings, but do we have any indication? Like, obviously last year was a big year for pulses in Western Canada. Is there any indication or signs of where farmers are headed this year?
Well, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, they just put out a report earlier this week, and their takeaway was more canola, less grains, or at least less durum. And the pulses were fairly steady, if I recall. I don't have the numbers in front of me on the pulses, but the on canola, they're expecting 21 million acres of canola, which would be up about half a million or so from last year.
Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate your thoughts and time and your expertise, Phil. We've been speaking with Phil Franz-Workington, reporter with Commodity News Service Canada in Winnipeg. Thanks again, Phil.
You are welcome.
The CRTC created quite a stir a few weeks back with a report that said broadband access should be considered an essential service in rural Canada. Rain News editor Leanne Minogue lives in rural Saskatchewan. She's here with some thoughts about what this really means.
I'm in my office this morning, in the basement of our house on the farm in southeast Saskatchewan. I've been reading about the announcement the CRTC released just before Christmas. It's about closing the broadband gap. I'm hoping there's some good news here, but I'm just waiting for the full report to download so I can read the whole thing. The CRTC is getting some good media coverage, and they probably deserve most of it. They have a new funding program, and their new press release talks about how important it is for all Canadians to have access to high-speed internet. I could not agree more. Our internet access here has good days and bad days. On good days, my husband can watch some of the farm machinery videos Scott Garvey puts up on the Grey News website. On bad days, videos are out of the question, and I have to read my email on my phone because it takes too long to download to my computer. Last week, I spent about 30 minutes using the online forms to update our farm's workers' compensation file. With high-speed internet, that job would have taken about 5 minutes. So when the CRTC agrees with me that high speed is important, I'm happy. But the fine print of the new announcement is not as great as I'd hoped. The CRTC is going to use its new $750 million fund to meet three new goals. One of them is about making sure there's mobile data available everywhere. If you don't have good cell service now, this could be great for you. But our farm's in the oil patch, so we've had good cell service for a while now. You can use your phone to access the internet on your computer. They call that a Wi-Fi hotspot, but if you've tried it, you know it's not as fast or as cheap as a real internet connection, and it's not a great solution for long-term, everyday use. The CRTC's other two goals are about having fixed broadband internet at home. They want everyone who has fixed broadband to have download speeds of 50 megabytes per second and an option to buy a package where they can download unlimited data every month. That's nice for some, but it doesn't help me. Fixed broadband usually means a cable or a cord brings data to your house. I don't have a cable like that. The nearest one is about 20 miles from our farm. We get our internet through what they usually call fixed wireless broadband. That means a dish on the roof that gets data from a tower 5 miles away. It's slower, obviously. The top speed offered by the company we use is 2 megabytes per second, about 25 times slower than the CRTC thinks city people need. In fact, it's even slower than the top speed the CRTC thinks I need. In 2011, the CRTC had a document that said it would be in the public interest to establish universal target speeds for broadband internet access in Canada. This should ensure that all Canadians, particularly those in rural and remote areas, can benefit from a great level of broadband connectivity. In this decision, the Commission establishes target speeds of 5 megabytes per second. I'm still waiting for that, just like I'm waiting for this report to download. We use the internet for business on our farm. We need it to learn about markets, to deal with bank accounts, to send data to our accountant. More and more, I'm finding that companies are gearing their services to people with high-speed internet, even companies that should understand my situation. Here's an example. When FCC updates its Ag Expert accounting software, they put the update online. In early January, when I needed new payroll information, I waited about an hour to download the update. To be fair, I should add, they would have mailed me a disc, but they would have charged me extra for that. Here's another example. My son used his birthday money to buy a new Xbox game. We used the disc in his box to load it up, and he was quite excited, but before our system would let him play, we had to download the update. It was 16 gigabytes. It took a week. I made the point before that this is not the first time something like this has happened. When power or phones or TV came to Prairie Cities, farmers were left behind for a long time. This isn't different. It's just frustrating. On the bright side, while I'm waiting for my files to load, I have plenty of time to explain the economics of rural infrastructure to my 10-year-old.
We'd like to thank Gowan Canada, our sponsor for today's Between the Rows podcast. Remember, if you have Group 1 or 2 resistant wild oats on your farm, use Avidex or Fortress to control them. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. If you like what you heard on today's show and you want to hear more, go to membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.